Hello and welcome. I'm Simon Adam, host of Crazy Making. Today I speak with Joyce Choi. Joyce is a nursing professor in the School of Community and Health Studies at Centennial College and a PhD candidate at York University in Toronto, Canada. Her clinical background is in the area of gerontological nursing. She's worked in the long-term care sector as a unit leader and nurse classifier with the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, a behavioral support outreach nurse, and an interprofessional nurse educator. Her current doctoral research examines the academic accommodation process in higher learning institutions while interrogating practices of the medicalization of mental health challenges. In other words, what Joyce's work will unearth is the ways in which college and university students become forced into medical categories and labels, primarily psychiatric, in order to be considered for academic accommodations in their respective school programs. Welcome, Joyce. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon.
Tell us, Joyce, what you are up to these days in terms of your research. What's happening?
Well, I think, thank you. I'm very excited to reach the milestone of being a PhD candidate for my research that examines accessibility in post-secondary education for students with mental health challenges. And so I'm really excited to move on to this next phase where I'm in the process of going through my ethics application and hopefully to begin data collection later this year. So I'm very excited to be able to reach this step.
Okay, so you mentioned something called a PhD candidate. So for the listeners who are not familiar with this language, can you explain what a PhD candidate is and how you get candidacy?
In terms of the PhD candidacy, to reach the stage, I would have to complete all the coursework that is required from the PhD program and then go through an examination in order to, and I did an oral exam and in preparation and also prepared a paper that is a publishable manuscript. So it was through the passing the examination that I am able to reach the PhD candidacy and be able to now be able to conduct the research that I have proposed as part of the examination. So now being able to move forward with my project in terms of the research design, the approach, the theoretical lens that I'm intending to use, and also the process I would like to proceed with the study. So yeah, so that's a little bit about the PhD candidacy element.
Okay, so in other words, a lot of work.
Yes, so very happy to be able to reach this stage, but definitely a lot of work.
Yeah, you mentioned something about a publishable paper. Can you talk a little bit about that paper and what it's about?
Absolutely. So I was really interested when I began my PhD journey and the fascination with the concept of resilience. So, and really how is that being contextualized within nursing and nursing education? So I've decided with the support of my supervisors and committee to really engage with doing a concept analysis using Rogers' evolutionary concept analysis to explore this particular concept. So with my review, I was able to distill 19 articles that really explore the concept of resilience, how it is being employed within nursing education, and then be able to generate how we can move forward, because I really want to challenge the way it is described, the way it is used. It is very individually focused, and that we should really look at other factors that do impact one's resilience. And so currently, I finished the manuscript and is currently under review right now. So I'm really excited to and look forward to be able to share this in a form of publication and really advocate for more of an inclusive way when we look at resilience and how we can support it through in a multidimensional way and really engage in how we can best support students within nursing education and really challenge the use of just the use of relying on that individual resiliency and really looking at some of the structural factors that might impact one's resiliency and how we can address that and support the nursing student population.
Yeah, very important work. You mentioned there's a bit of a problem with the way resilience is understood right now in the nursing literature, that it's a very individual based framing, and we should probably look at more sort of structural sort of factors, if you will, structural factors that impact one's resilience. What are structural factors? Can you maybe help us understand what a structural factor is or what examples of such structural factors might be that impact resilience?
Absolutely. So I think that when we're looking at students' resilience, there are a lot of factors, for example, financial factors that might result in impacting one's resilience or access to services. There are other things that are outside of the individual control. And some of the things that I could think of is during the pandemic, looking at internet use and issues, because we were all of a sudden pivot from a in-person learning environment to an online environment. And so in a family that normally would have one person on the internet now is supporting multiple people that are using the internet. So how does that impact students' learning experience and access to education, access to lecture that is majority is used in an online platform? And then so when we look at all of these nuances and factors, so it's not just an individual's ability to cope in order to be successful within education, but also what are some of the other elements that are outside of the individual control that might impact one's resilience within the nursing program? And how can we look at ways to address some of these barriers? Because before the pandemic, students can access the internet at school. But during the pandemic, we are really reliant on our home use of internet or the access to other resources as well. In some of the reports I read, you know, having people that might have lost their jobs, for example, that are very reliant on the income that would be required to continue to engage with education, and how does that impact one's resilience? So these are just examples that resilience is impacted not just like in individual factors, but there are also social factors that impact that whole element that we see as resilience. And that's what I would mean by the structural factors that would impact one's resilience and how we need to look at it from a broader perspective.
Right. And just sort of staying with the problem of the individualization of resilience, what do you think are some consequences if we work with resilience as a sort of individualized notion?
Well, I think that when we look at it through an individualized notion, then we just focus on the problem being on the person themselves. And there are structural barriers that would impede that is out of the person's control. So I think that when we just focus on solving problems from individual to individual, we're really not benefiting the impact that might affect multiple peoples. So that in itself is problematic, that we need to really look at more broader perspective and broader strategies that sometimes is harder to measure, but sometimes it is important in order to support that resiliency concept that might impact more to certain groups, certain individuals, and really looking at ways to broaden that up and really not focus on that individual solution element. So looking at more of the broader changes that would open opportunities for everyone that might be impacted. So this is what I would believe to even for an example, one that I could think of is the internet for students that are living in Northern Ontario. Right. So I know that through the pandemic, there's more push now to make sure that there is high speed internet that is available through Northern Ontario. That in itself is a structural element to really solve some of the things that are not just affecting when we're looking at localized individual issues, when we solve it through a more broader social issues that we are benefiting a more people that would otherwise be disadvantaged.
So it sounds like if we were to sort of focus this idea of resiliency as located within the individual, as up to the individual or the responsibility of the individual alone, it's kind of sounds like what is otherwise known as victim blaming, right? That sort of idea of victim blaming.
Exactly.
Yeah, right, yeah. Okay. Well, this is, it's, for sure, it's an interesting paper, Joyce. This is a small part of your PhD and not necessarily what your PhD research is about. It's just sort of one adjunct piece. Given that, are you able to sort of kind of just summarize or explain to us what exactly is your PhD dissertation research about? What are you looking to discover?
Absolutely. So my PhD research project was really stemmed from an initial project that I did with my colleagues on looking at academic accommodation in post-secondary education. And through our qualitative study, one of the things, it revealed a lot of interesting information, but one of the things that revealed was students' experiences through the accommodation process and the necessity in order to receive additional resources and support and be able to apply for funding that students required to enter into the medical discourse, that they need to be diagnosed with a particular mental health problem in order to receive those support. And I recall one of our study participants talked about her barriers of going to a physician's office and sharing with the physician of their the barriers that they were encountering and sharing with them the symptoms of anxiety and being disregarded and saying that your anxiety is not severe enough, and therefore I cannot provide that substantiating diagnosis. And the student had to go back to counseling and to our accommodation center to share that information. So what the student was required to do was to then go into the accommodation office every semester in order to renegotiate and to get access. So this is the entry point into my research project and really questioning and challenging that medicalization element for students to access and use academic accommodation within the education system. So my research really looking at it through an institutional processes. I will be employing institutional ethnography to explore this multi-dimensional and complex issue. So yeah, so in a nutshell, this is kind of like my starting point into my doctoral dissertation research.
Interesting. So if I could hazard to summarize that, you're looking to examine and really understand students' experiences, those enrolled in post-secondary programs and specifically nursing, as they go about getting, you know, getting accommodations and getting their accommodation requests applied so that they can, so it can enhance their learning or they can, so they can have sort of more equitable access to learning as they're going through their degrees, but also specifically with a critical look at how and why it is that certain experiences or certain, I guess, feelings or what you call it, anxiety or whatever, have to be or become medicalized, or they have to be seen by a medical professional and sort of legitimized by a document, then they can be processed through the system, sort of looking at that critically as well.
Yes, that's right.
Interesting. It was compelling project. And so, and where are you now with that?
So right now I'm in the applying for ethics in order to conduct the study. And then I hope that I will be able to begin my data collection in the in later on this year.
All right, great. Ethics. So yeah. So for our listeners who are not familiar with what that is, typically anybody conducting research that involves institutions, organizations, human participants, animals, biohazards, and all that sort of stuff must receive permission from the institutions that they are doing the research in and the institutions that house them. So that is a complicated application that the researcher has to put in and make sure that certain safeguards are put in place to protect the participants of the study. That's kind of it, really, in a nutshell.
Yeah,
great. Thanks for that. Yeah, thanks, Joyce. That's interesting work you're doing. And it's certainly, as you said, it's complex and convoluted and complicated. And I wish you luck with that. And very important, of course.
Thank you.
My next question actually sort of has to do with looking at, I guess, in the context of your work, looking at the medicalization process itself. Maybe let's define what medicalization is to begin with. What is it? What is medicalization?
So medicalization is a process where a person's experience has to be legitimized by a medical healthcare profession. So if someone's experienced depression, symptoms of depression, that in order to be identified or recognized, it needs to be substantiated by a healthcare provider in order to legitimize that particular experience. So yeah, and it turns out that it's really pushing or giving the process of giving a human problem to be really entering into our medical profession jurisdiction, which in itself is quite problematic because it's such a subjective element, and this is something that is near and dear to my heart, that processes that that I find it very challenging to have to enter into that medical discourse in order for one to be legitimized and justified and validated. So yeah,
right. So it's like taking sort of everyday normal or natural human experiences and turning them into medical issues or medical problems that are diagnosable and treatable, and so on. So, you know, I guess the example I'm thinking of, and this is a pretty simple one, like a hair loss, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, hair loss for some people is a natural phenomenon associated with the changes in hormonal levels and aging and the changing and the sort of natural progression of the aging body, right?
Yeah.
And then when it gets picked up and becomes known as alopecia, you know, as its medical concept. And then there is, you know, ready-made interventions in the form of medications and surgical procedures to quote unquote treat alopecia, this, a presumably natural phenomenon. That's kind of like a really like a simple example of medicalization of something that's a natural, not necessarily subjective human experience. It's really quite objective because, you know, hair falls out and you could see it and you could feel it. It's just natural and not necessarily medical. Yeah.
And that's part of the thing with mental health, right? And I think that what truly makes this problematic is that without that diagnosis, without that being medicalized, that one is limited to what support or resources that one would have access to. And sometimes it's just seeing additional barriers one must go through in order to get that support. So this is where sometimes in my experience with students, sometimes they don't want to enter into that being with that label, right? And looking at some of the stigma and the impacts. And sometimes I see really wonderful potential nursing students that are end up not getting the support that they need and then leaving the program. And that's the part where really motivated this area to really look into what are some of the barriers one might experience, and even just obtaining that accommodation, and also how does one able to use that accommodation, and what are some of the successes and what are some of the barriers one might encounter with those processes within the program. It's something that I'm really interested in looking at.
So if we were to apply medicalization to mental health, it would be something like sort of everyday or sort of natural or expected feelings, emotions, experiences people have. For example, a student might be experiencing performance anxiety if they have to present a project in front of 120 students. And that sort of, it might be repetitive, it might be somewhat impeding to their social lives and their sort of academics. But there could be sort of very legitimate reasons for why certain people feel certain types of anxieties or sadnesses or depressions or whatever. But when some students require that extra support for them to reach that equitable level of learning within their institutions, have to be forced into these categories of disability or medicalization or having to get legitimate paperwork documentation from a physician or a psychologist or a counselor to be able to be to ask for that sort of whatever it is, that sort of extra support, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's kind of where that's what you're after.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And really looking at the process and how one negotiates and what are the institution that kind of governs that element, and what are some of the and how does that translate to what this end at the end of the day, what the students encounter. And sometimes it could be barriers that one might not foresee, right? Even though accommodation could be negotiated every semester with the counselor, but that in itself, could that be a potential barrier of having to getting that negotiating back every semester? So looking at all the nuances and elements and really looking at exploring this issue further within my dissertation research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, just going back a little bit to sort of mental health, psychiatry and psychiatric labels, I think, and I've heard it, kind of said both ways, right? Where some people do really want to seek a diagnosis to so they can sort of put it to rest that what they're experiencing is actually something, quote unquote, legitimate medical. There is an explanation for it. And others do quite the opposite. They kind of want to stay away from that sort of labeling, sort of being pegged into, a box or a category or a diagnosis, if you will. So I imagine you might find differing opinions with these student experiences, some who might be seeking that to sort of get some sort of understanding and maybe seek comfort in that diagnosis, while others just actually rejecting it, not wanting anything to do with it.
Oh, absolutely. I think that is such a key in some of my students' experiences. But I think the part that is the barrier is that when they cannot get that substantiation, right? And they're encountering that barriers in having that, that their experience is being validated and that it is something going on, right? But not when they don't have that substantiation. Again, that encountering that barrier that in itself is it's kind of like, what are some of these barriers that one might want to seek help and unable to, or how does our current education system support different diverse learners and diverse learning needs, and what can we do to improve and do better, right? Because I think that I just see so many great potential nursing students and really what are some of the ways that we could continue to enhance and continue to improve our education system so that we can support that diverse workforce and be able to support all learners' needs within the nursing program. So I'm very interested to engage further in this, in my research into this area.
Awesome. And how long would it take you to do all this research?
That's a really great question. I do hope that within the next year that I'm able to conduct this research and be able to start that and simultaneously doing data analysis with this particular project and be able to start analyzing my findings. So currently my timeline is within 1 year timeline for this particular project.
Great. Sounds good. So maybe we can invite you back on the show in about a year and ask you about your findings and the implications of your findings. That'd be interesting.
Absolutely. I would be honored to do that.
Joyce, if you know, you're, it sounds like the primary people you're going to be working with this research is students in a college and a university. If you were to speak to them now or give them any sort of advice emerging out of your research, what would it be?
I wanted to give the advice that do seek out, do reach out to for support. I think one of the biggest barriers I see, and sometimes it's really hard, especially going through various experiences, but just really knowing that there is support mechanism out there, that you're not alone. And that it is important that to be able to reach out. And I know that even some of our academic resources are really valuable and really be I hope that we can continue. I really wanted to engage with nursing students and be able to really support they're really, I think it is important with my research. One of the things is that really engage with, and I truly believe in the disability justice and that the person that our experiences should be the driver of that solution. So I really wanted to engage with nursing students in this particular area and really engage them and see what they would see as solution focus, what would be meaningful for them from an institutional perspective in supporting them through their academic journey with their needs and really bring in a voice and advocacy in that lens. So, yeah. So not really specific advices, but just kind of even just the vision, right? And really be an ally and really allow my participants to really, you know, see what their needs are and really explore deep into that issue. But yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, specific enough to the stage of where you are in the stage of your research, and you'll have presumably more specific findings and implications as you actually complete the research later on. And we'd love to hear more at that time. Thanks, Joyce. Thank you for appearing on the show. And thanks for your wisdom and the really wonderful work that you're doing. And I look forward to chatting with you again. Joyce is a nursing professor in the School of Community and Health Studies at Centennial College and a doctoral candidate at York University, Toronto, Canada. Thank you very much, Joyce.
Thank you, Simon.
Subscribe and listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. Reach out to us by email at crazymaking@yorku.ca. That's crazymaking@yorku.ca. And follow us on Instagram @crazymakingpodcast. Thanks for listening.